Hi, I'm Brad Bernthal. I'm the director of the Entrepreneurship Initiative here at the Silicon Flatiron Center. You are at Entrepreneurs Unplugged. Really looking forward to tonight's event with Tim and Ryan from Rally and Brad Feld, who will be moderating. We've got two CU alums. I think this is this might be the first CU alum that we've had in an Unplugged period. Oh, no. Walter Knapp from ITP was
CU. We're talking two double CU alums.
Yeah.
Yeah. Undergrad and grad.
Yeah, so to the fourth power is what we're dealing with tonight. We had a duo from Legit, for those of you who saw the Entrepreneurs Unplugged, with Todd Vernon and Walter Knapp last year. I'm really looking forward to this. It worked out great, so this should be a lot of fun. Quickly, sponsors of tonight's event are Silicon Flatirons. Is Jill Vamadri here from Atlas, where we usually are? There's Jill. And ITP, is Elizabeth Golder here as well? Okay. Quick plug for Wednesday night, Tom Keller is going to be over in Atlas at 6 o'clock discussing your market and customers as part of the New Venture Challenge series. So for entrepreneurs and wannabe entrepreneurs, I suggest that to your attention. And then next Wednesday here at 6 o'clock in the law school, Jason Hazelmeyer will be doing an IP crash course. So with that, quickly I want to do a quick introduction and then we'll get into it. Brad Feld, our moderator, is the managing director at Foundry Group. He's a venture capitalist and entrepreneur. Tim Miller is the CEO. Tim, you want a dramatic wave? Very well done. He's the CEO of Rally Software. Rally helps organizations perfect the art of software development through agile and lean practices. I'm a lawyer, so I just take this at face value. Rally is a four-time winner of the highly coveted Jolt Award, the software industry equivalent of the Oscar. It's one of the fastest-growing companies and also one of the top companies to work for in Colorado for 3 years running, which I suspect you're very proud of. Tim holds a master's in information systems and a BA in economics from the University of Colorado at Boulder and has more than 18 years of management experience. He's been honored as an Esprit Entrepreneur of the Year and a finalist for the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award as well. Ryan Martins is the founder and chief technology officer of Rally. He brings proven leadership in high-growth software companies. He holds a master's in business administration and his bachelor's of science in civil engineering from CU. This is his fourth startup. Before Rally, Ryan directed the corporate adoption of internet technologies at Quest, and then he moved on to co-found Avitech, a Boulder-based custom software development firm, with Tim. Ryan's successful efforts, along with Tim at Avitech, culminate in acquisition by BEA Systems in 1999. They're both highly involved with several community organizations, including, happily, this one. Please welcome Ryan and Tim for Entrepreneurs Unplugged.
So just to frame this for those of you that haven't been at one of these before, we've got about 45 minutes to an hour. We'll break it up into three sections. So I'm going to do, Brad and I will do a little bit of sort of historical interview, get a sense of Tim and Ryan's backgrounds, how they met, et cetera. We'll spend a chunk of time sort of dealing with current reality, what Rally is about, what's going on with Rally, sort of how they've seen and built the software company they're involved in today. And then at the end, the last 15, 20 minutes or so, do Q&A. So please feel free to queue up your questions. If you don't have them, I can go on forever, so don't worry, no pressure. And with that, let's get started. Since this is a duo interview, some of the questions will be aimed at one of you and some will be aimed at both of you. The first one's kind of for each. Maybe spend a few minutes talking about, you know, what happened from the time that you graduated from CU to the point that you started your first company. So, Tim, you want to start with that?
Sure. Graduating from CU was actually a huge deal. I failed out, got back in, and graduated, I think, with about a 2.1. So I was not set up in a particularly good position to be able to get a high-paying job. I moved to Arizona, got into the real estate business in 1988, which was the worst real estate recession we've seen up to what we may see here in the future in commercial real estate. So it wasn't a great start. So I went back to school, got an MBA in finance from ASU, and got into consulting, loved it, but loved school even more. So came back to CU, tried to get my PhD in finance, basically failed in that again, and defaulted and got a master's in information system, which is where I met Ryan. After getting that degree, Ryan started as the first employee of a small consulting company. I was the second employee, and the three partners that founded it and us grew that business to about 40 people very successfully and profitably. We ejected from that in large part because, in my case, I'll just tell my story now, I wanted to create a software company, and I wasn't going to be able to do that inside. So I started a company called Avatech, grew to 40 people, about a $10 million run rate, sold it to BEA Systems, where I continued to run what was called the Accelerated Development Center, which used a lot of the concepts that we use in our product today. Did that for a year and a half until they sucked my brain dry. Went and lived on a sailboat with my wife and two daughters for a year and a half in the Caribbean and Mediterranean. Came back, worked as an EIR at Boulder Ventures, and then joined Ryan about 1 year to the day after becoming an EIR, which is an entrepreneur in residence, to help get Rally going commensurate with our first round of institutional financing from the venture capitals, Brian Bradfeld being one of them, and Kyle Lovecoff being the other from Boulder Ventures.
So my story had to go backwards too after graduation, since Tim and I had very similar stories at CU. I started in civil engineering and found out we didn't have a CS major at that point in time, or the university didn't have a CS major, and so I found out all my A's were coming from CS classes. Those were my electives. But they didn't create the major until a couple years later, and I didn't want to go backwards, so I created a kind of a minor in CS, picked my own majors or my own classes I wanted to take, and came out as a BS in civil engineering with a minor in CS, and there was about as many people wanted to hire me as they wanted to hire Tim. I had my first startup while I was at CU and wrote a foreclosure application for a gentleman here in town, of which was endless scope creep, never finally delivered. I don't know how many hours I worked that summer on this application, only to deliver something that was never quite good enough. So I found my way into product management, believe it or not, trying to figure out how that whole world worked. So I ended up taking a sales job for a software company here in town, a little company called Small System Design, of which 20%, this is a great Boulder story, of which 20% of the profits of Small System Design went to the Church of Scientology. Didn't find that out until after I'd been there for about a year working.
Did they have health care?
We had great health care, yeah.
As long as you believe.
Exactly. Yes. So I ran direct sales, filling out bingo cards, people that fill out bingo cards in back of magazines. Then I ended up running their dealer channel and decided I really like software, and clearly I had to fix my major problem. So I went back and got an MBA with an emphasis in CS, and one of my professors is sitting right here, Clayton Lewis, who taught the AI and survey programming languages, and I came out as a director of product management and product marketing, and took a job at what was by far the most enticing place I could ever imagine, in Bozeman, Montana, working for a spinoff of Hewlett Packard. All about place, second was everything else. So moved up to Bozeman, Montana. We were starting a new product up there, and it was in the fax business, and we were trying to figure out exactly what this thing was going to do, and trying to play around with the market. And we had another sister fax business down in Boise, Idaho, and we shipped 1,000 bad boards, fax boards, into distribution. So these fax boards would slip into the MIO slot or the extension slots of HP printers, and they would print your faxes on an HP printer. Well, that was a great deal until we shipped 1,000 bad boards and you didn't get your faxes. So we basically took ourselves completely out of the entire fax business in one fell swoop, including the division I was working on in Bozeman, Montana, of which there really are no other jobs in Bozeman, Montana, unless you're going to go work in a bike shop. So that's how we find ourselves. One of the guys we met in graduate school at CU, and due to a professor in the business school who had worked with a number of students over time, was trying to start this new consulting company, and he went back into our class and the subsequent classes after he had graduated to pick up pretty capable folks who could do modeling and business analysis, and that's how we started the company in Denver called Resource Integration. That was 92.
So I've had the benefit of working with you guys as partners and watching you guys work as partners for a long time. Talk about what it was like when you first met each other. You know, you've been involved in two businesses together, but when you first met each other at whatever drunken party you were at, you know, what was the first reaction? Sort of how did the relationship develop? What kind of things did you do together to get to know each other? Legal things.
My first reaction was Ryan worked for the Object Management Group, which was an early group that was trying to promote object technology. We were in the Object Management, Object Paradigm Research Group, OPRG, at CU with the professor David Menarche, where we didn't have anything better to do than to go learn more at night, and we just loved this class. And he was at the OMG, and he brought that industry knowledge into the classroom and got up and said, people just want plug and play. Plug and play is where it's at with software. And he sounded like he really knew what he was talking about. And, of course, he was kind of full of shit. But I was so impressed with how confident he was about suggesting a market dynamic that I always looked at this guy and said, he's really smart. I should figure out a way to work with him.
Yeah, that was pretty much full of shit. I spent, for some reason, as Tim describes, kind of lowly descriptions of what you do in your off hours. For some reason, back then they used to ship big industry press mags. InfoWorld was by far my favorite. And I read that cover to cover every week it came out. That was, in graduate school, I was just enamored with the software industry. And I got an internship while I was in the graduate school for the Object Management Research Group. So I got way into marketing while I was doing that. And so it was pretty much as all marketers are, pretty much full of tongue.
I've trained you well.
Yeah. So that was how Tim remembers it. Tim, when we started this consulting company, Tim brought in a lot of understanding of stuff, of fiddling with things. If you know Tim and why, how you can spend a year on a boat, you have to know how to fix everything. Tim actually knows how to fix everything when it comes to hardware and when it comes to networking stuff, and took our consulting company back in 1992 and put us on the internet. So we all got slip accounts, slip and PPP accounts, for those people who know what those are, which is dial-up accounts to basically an email server that was, you could think of, kind of in the cloud. And as a result of that, that put us on a trajectory that we'll probably talk about of throwing a lot of stuff at the wall associated with the internet. And the thing that we mentioned about Quest Communications was we had the joy of working with a 20-year veteran at Quest from the network side of the business who came down to Denver from Seattle. And we started working with internet technologies back then. And Quest had obviously a lot of network and was trying to figure out what to do with all this stuff. And Tim's work with this allowed us to create this thing at US West that was, they called the Global Village, but it was basically an intranet. But it was the first intranet. And when we started playing with that, there were 35 different companies listed on the World Wide Web. That was 1994, and the only browser you could get was a NCSA browser.
I love the What's New page.
Yeah.
There was a What's New page for the internet.
Because there was new things that came up every week.
There was usually something that hit it maybe every day or two.
So what were those things that we learned from? We worked our asses off as consultants. We were about 1 or 2 minutes in front of what we were supposed to be doing, because we really didn't know a whole hell of a lot, but we figured out we could learn real quickly, and we had a couple of great consulting coaches who knew what to do, how to get leverage by putting young people in front of what were very big companies and just seeing if you sunk or swam. And we kept swimming, and Tim was the one who put us out, I think, on the edge about how to use those technologies, and that's had a huge shaping function in my career and certainly in where we've been.
So this was 93, 94. You guys were very early in this company. It grew to about 40 people, but you weren't founders of it.
Correct.
What was the internal conversation between the two of you as you were starting to both get restless with the company you're working for as well as the formative creation of Avatech?
So it's an interesting story. I checked out first out of that company that we hired as that consulting company was trying to scale and replicate and get. We were working with Tim had been working out of Schwab. I've been at U.S. Western in the telecommunications space for a while, working on billing systems and customer service systems. And we hired in a person who came out of an investment banking group, a gentleman out of New York, to help run the company while two of the founders basically went out and worked on a deal in San Francisco. And he smelled evil the moment I met him. Dripped evil. I quit in the first week I saw him. Tim was mostly in Australia at that point in time doing a bunch of network work down in Australia and Ceylon?
Roosevelt
Networks Division at HP. So he and I were working together. We worked on a project at US West for a while. We would cross paths through these consulting projects, but he was out in Roseville and working on big network stuff, and I was like, this guy's going to live here in Denver. He's changing the whole way of things. So I left. I checked out.
And when you checked out, what did you do?
I went to work for another consulting company that was working in U.S. West and continuing. I ended up being a director at U.S. West for a while as a consultant in there and really trying to figure out what to do next because that...
safe landing, easy exit.
Yeah, exactly. So you bailed on the evil guy. Tim stuck it out for a little while because he was in California. So how did that play out? Did you know this guy was evil?
He had tremendous power, and he had qualities that I deeply admired. If they could have been used for good, then I think he could have really made a difference in the world. But unfortunately, he was evil, and there's some
Is
interesting.
He a
stuff. I don't know. I suspect not.
Has he ever interviewed at Rally?
He has not. But what I did learn from that really quickly was. You can hire one person in a small company, 30, 40 people, and if you don't do something about it, they can destroy it almost overnight. And that was one of the strongest lessons I learned as an entrepreneur early on and why I care so much about corporate culture. Getting bad people on the bus and putting them in a position of power and authority is a very dangerous thing. And as a result, I guess I have a hard time hiring senior people, but I've done okay with it. I went ahead and started the first company. It resulted from a 9-page PowerPoint deck that I presented to the board of this consulting company, including the evil one. And I said I would give them 50% of the company. All I asked in return was 1-year salary and the ability to go out and pursue this. And that I would sell my own work and I would go do it. I'd give them 50% for my salary. And my salary, I believe, was about $45,000 a year. So it wasn't a big salary. They said, we'd love it. We really want to do this. And we got a billable project that starts on Monday. So you're going to have to do this in your spare time. So I went off and I quit, and it took me about 3 or 4 months before I kind of got everything lined up and went ahead and started it. I sublet some space from a guy by the name of Andrew Curry, who had a very successful company called Message Media, formerly Email Publishing. He wanted to do reference checks and wasn't sure I was going to be able to pay the $400 a month rent, but I finally convinced him that I would be able to pay. I think I had to pay 3 months in advance. And sort of the rest is history. Bootstrap, self-funded company, all in maybe $25,000, $30,000 of capital in order to build that company into the $10 million business without any outside capital.
So talk about the first year or so of that business. So your new landlord tortures you for a little while. You can't get enough credit to get a coffee maker, so you have to borrow the one that he has to borrow from down the hall because he doesn't have any money either. How does it play out? So here you are, you put your shingle out. What happens next?
I spent the first two weeks buying a server, by hand putting it together because I thought I could save a few $100, but back then people built PCs a lot more often than they do now. And then the third week I went out and sold a contract, and I did all the work myself, and it was maybe a 1 or 2 week gig, and then the fifth or sixth week I went out and sold another contract, and I hired an intern from CU. I paid him $6 an hour, and he did some of the work, and I kept selling, and I got my third and my fourth and my fourth, and I hired an engineer for $70,000, and he loves to tell the story that I hired him, but I made him bring his own computer. And he did bring bring his own computer, and we got going. He was awesome. His name is Steve Wilcox, and I've been working with Steve almost as long as Ryan. He's been with us through Avatech and BEA and now Rally. So we just gained momentum. Ryan joined us, five or six people in, and we used to say worked with us sort of through osmosis because he was still working for this other consulting company. But Ryan's been able to pretty much ask for whatever he wants in his career because he's so smart. And the other office said, you can work anywhere you want, so go work with Rally. We sold a big project in Avatech, thank you. We sold a big contract to this consulting company, and I don't think you were working directly with us, but it was a great synergistic relationship, and then formally joined us maybe when we were about 8 or 10.
What do you remember of the sort of beginnings of Avatech when you went from working for this other consulting company to now working for Avatech full-time? What was that transition like?
The company I went to work for that I left was starting a commercial consulting division here in Denver. They're mostly a Beltway consulting company. And so there wasn't anything really special about them by any stretch of the imagination, other than some of the relationships we had with clients. And that place also had an evil story to it of we got a new vice president who ran commercial division back in the Beltway, and we had to go out and present to her what we were doing. And I had started, we'd done so many new customer service facing systems using internet technology that I had started working on an entrepreneurial thing to propose this to other telecom companies, that we would take a lot of the stuff we'd done at US West and be able to provide that to other companies. And we're in a validation phase with a number of very large companies in that regard, and she basically shut it all down. And so we fell back into our roots of working on learning systems using internet technology to train service reps how to use green screen applications. And that's when I got them to hire Avatech to build the first Java-based client of that thing. And then I started working at Avatech and really, in a marketing standpoint, Tim and I were both able to carry pretty good large amount of projects underneath us as engagement managers, but I helped kind of put some of the focus onto the company about we really were going to differentiate with the technology. All we did was Java development. We became a Sun Certified Java Center, one of the first ones of those. That got us hooked up with the folks at WebLogic, who were a very young Java application server at that point in time. They got acquired into BEA. We happened to be one of their primary service providers. That our model was, because we needed to bootstrap everything, this is one of Tim's ideas, but it dovetails into all this stuff really well. If you figure out, if you bill weekly, in 4 weeks you can figure out if you've got a sucky client or a good client. And if you've got a bad one, you fire them, because they're not going to pay you and you're going to spend way too much time with them anyway. So we delivered work every week, and that's how we got into this agile and iterative development process. Was we would deliver every week and major deliverables every 6 weeks, but we billed every week. And as a result of billing every week, we could use the cash flow from our customers to build the company. And that finance side of it, agile development side of it, married up with a fairly hot set of technologies and a great market around the telecom community here in Denver was kind of part of that story. So we focused on Java, and as a result, we became critical to WebLogic and then BEA, because they only got license revenue when these applications got put into production. It was free for developers, but cost money to put it into production. Well, we would do it in 6 weeks. And we were really good at doing it in 6 weeks, so that was our big value proposition was, well, the sales reps now could get paid 6 weeks after they actually got the development seats in hand. Well, we got married up with the Western Regional sales rep, who is now our EVP of sales, Don Hazel, and our fourth partner.
We have some students here tonight who might be thinking about starting a business, coming right out of school, out of, say, a graduate program. Did you need the consulting experience looking back? Could Avatech had happened from a skill set perspective without the consulting experience before?
I think it would have been bloody. I think we could have, and I believed that I wanted to be an entrepreneur before working at the consulting firm. But my dad, who was also an entrepreneur, gave me some good advice that I took to heart, which is go spend somebody else's money, make some mistakes when you can afford, when it doesn't cost you anything. And there are few things better than working 70, 80 hours a week for 2-3 years for different customers trying to solve their most strategic problems that I can think of. Obviously, that's not necessarily the easiest path, but I think I learned more in that 3 years by year than probably any time with the possible exception of Rally, because running a venture-backed software is a lot different than just running a business, and that's another step function in sophistication and being in a product company, but that was great, and I don't think I would have been successful.
We ran a project business, right? And so we were negotiating with International as well as the Department of Defense. We had pretty sophisticated clients, and I don't think if we had known how to engagement manage those kinds of things and what that looked and smelled like, if it was going to be a successful project or if you'd set it up right from charter, we learned from some great folks in the consulting industry about how to set things up to make them run successful, even on short sprints.
And had we had mentors like we had at that business, yes, I think we would have been successful. Yeah.
So my answer would have been no. I didn't know how to run projects like that. I didn't know how to. And, you know, at Avatech, why we were so successful is we kept all of our customers. They just kept adding more and more projects to us because we were much better than any internal IT development, both in the technology as well as our delivery as well as our ability to scope out the work.
We did maybe 15 projects for US West, and over 50% of our revenue we were a sub to somebody else selling it. We did work over and over and over again with the subs. So we're outsourced IT.
So Avatech was bootstrap business, $25,000 total in it, you know, scraping it together to buy servers and things like that. You started in 96 or 95?
I think it was the end of 95.
95, end of 95.
I started in mid-96.
So sort of 96, 97, 98, what was the ramp as you built to a $10 million company, recognizing that you had no real investment, you had to make money every month to pay people?
I think we grew plus or minus 2%, 100% every year. And I think we were within a couple percent of our budget every year.
Mm-hmm. So doubled every year.
We were profitable every month of its existence.
Did you have any oh shit cash flow moments?
We had a defining moment in the company where we had half to two thirds of our staff working for a company called Intalis, which was a pretty interesting company back in 97 that was sold to Orem, then sold to Bond. Is Bond still in business? I don't know about them much.
They've long been sold.
They were in a death march project where I'm getting my stories confused.
Two
different stories.
Configurator.
Yeah, no, that wasn't the project I'm talking about. Oh yeah, it is.
Yeah.
We had two very similar projects. The end result was we weren't going to be successful. No, it's a different project. This is a company called DMW Group in Colorado Springs. We weren't going to be successful. We're building a $10 million system. We're about $1 million in. There was no technology behind on the servers where this consulting company who had sold it said there was a bunch of stuff. And they had asked us to basically work 24 hours a day and staff round the clock 24/7 in order for them to be successful, rather than fire them as a customer, which I thought was the wrong thing to do, and I think we were great partners. We had an ultimatum, which probably was the wrong approach. But we pre-sold it to the guy running the project and said, listen, if this is going to be successful, we have to run it because it's being run into the ground and there's no chance for it to be successful. And if there's no chance for it to be successful, we don't want to be part of it anymore because we're just taking money for – we weren't doing anything because there was no work to be done because there was no software there. We made that pitch. It was not received in the light I had hoped. I offered to take the project on a fixed bid, which would have bankrupted the company, I'm sure, because I felt it was very important to give them an option. They rejected it summarily. We told them, that's fine. We'll roll our people off 2 a week. We did it in 4 weeks. We lost about $500,000 in revenue per month that was sustaining us, and somehow we were able to get those folks back billable on within a matter of weeks. But that defining moment in the company set a cultural element for Avatech that let people know we won't make you work 24/7 indefinitely on a stupid project. We care about you. And you know, as a result of that and other things, we had hugely high retention, and we believed we could do anything. And firing a customer was probably the most significant event in the company.
So let's shift into selling the company. So you guys sold the company to the very first company that came calling, right?
That's number four.
That's a joke.
Okay.
No, absolutely not.
Sarcasm.
Talk about what that was like. So you're running this profitable company. You're making money every month. You're growing. You've got a nice, vibrant business. What was the first overture like? What happened?
Was it US Web?
I think they were second.
The first one was Yosemite Sam, right?
Yes.
So we had this guy with the little horseshoe ring and the diamonds on it.
Take my ring off.
He definitely walked into the room and lit it up.
They were doing a roll-up.
They were doing a roll-up. They were buying a bunch of companies. And we got kind of close because we were going to get a bunch of equity in the new company. And it was a decent amount of cash. And we were early and naive. And the corp dev guy called me aside about a week before this might close and said, listen, these guys, you don't want to do this deal. I said, thank you so much. And so we walked from it.
That was Osage, I think was the name
Osage
of that company.
Osage was the company.
So I get to do US Web.
Yeah.
So if anybody remembers US Web as a roll-up company, their CEO, after this point in time that we actually talked to him, wrote a book, and maybe we can talk a little bit about his book, but they were also a roll-up of services companies, much like CKS and other web development shops in the late 90s, trying to pull together an agency that could do not only great design, but great web development, and the value was going to be they were going to take on the Anderson Consultings of the world, et cetera. So we went out to Silicon Valley to meet with them at their headquarters. They were flying high like all those companies were back then, and they had a pretty regimented model. Here's what you get. Here's how it works. We've done 30 of these things, and you're just not 31 in the process. We said no to that, and the book came out, I think the topic came out maybe 2 weeks later afterwards. The book came out later, but he had an encounter with aliens. And so he was the CEO and CTO founder of the organization and made that public, that he had had a close experience with them and that he had now had gone to a different level than most of the rest of us in the world. That was another near miss.
The 800-page treatise on his abduction was definitely scary. Now in the interview process, my last question to every candidate is, suppose a UFO lands in your backyard, an alien gets out and says, come with us, what would you do? And if anybody answers the question yes, they are not going to be hired. So, yes, it happens.
So let me add to the story, because you guys probably don't know this. So when I was at it used to be called SoftBank Venture Capital, Mobius, one of my partners at Mobius, Gary Richelle, was on the US Web board. And in fact, the CEO who saw aliens is a guy named Joe Firmich, who I spoke to on the telephone the other day because we're trying to hunt him down for something. And for sport, yeah. I needed a connection.
Nice.
Yes. The most remarkable thing about SoftBank in this time period was it was just the amount of crazy shit that was going on every day because we had so many investments and they were, you know, US Web at the peak was, I think, $8 billion market cap or something like this for a professional services firm that never made any money. And you get these emails, and I got this, you know, sort of Gary sent out this email and said, you never believe what would happen, and there was a URL link. And that wasn't that common to send URLs around at this point. You know, today it's no big deal. But then it was, you know, you get a URL, you click through no matter what. And it's a picture of a photograph of Joe in front of his house with news vans everywhere. And the headline in, like, the Mercury News is, public company CEO visited by aliens. And you know, you're kind of like, well, just another day. Right? He wasn't CEO for very long after that, if you remember correctly. All right, so you passed on that. That was probably not dumb because several years later, US Web went bankrupt for the second time and was bought for like $30 million. Went bankrupt the first time and was bought for $60 million by Divine, which was another roll-up. And then that company went bankrupt, and I think US Web ultimately sort of vanished from the earth.
I think that's right.
So, all right, so you're having some of these encounters with roll-up guys. What next?
The first one failed, SH2.
Did IXL ever come calling?
We never talked to them. We know some folks that did, but we didn't. Navidec in Denver, public company, decent market cap, company about our size, and we got really close with these guys, and this was probably 5x value that we'd seen just a year ago. 99, things were really hot still, I don't know who approached us first, whether or not it was BEA or Navidec, but we had them both, and we played them off each other a little bit, and ultimately the Navidec deal was better on paper, but it was all stock, and I would have been the largest stockholder of a public company, I say this nicely, I didn't have a lot of confidence in the future prospects of that business, and so we took about 2/3 of that in cash from BEA, and but having the competitive bid hugely helped,
So you sold to BEA in 99.
Yep.
August.
And how long did you stay at BEA?
I had accrued a lot of vacation. So I took about 6 weeks off in the first year and a half, maybe 5 quarters. That was really hard. I remember my daughter saying, you know, what? And it was really hard to leave, too. I said, well, if you hate your job, why don't you leave? And I said, well, I really care about the people. And I don't want to let them down, and I want to help them through their transition. And I was able to play a role to sort of keep a bunch of the corporate politics away from them. And there was some really important work. I don't think I did it at year and a quarter, but I was part of it in the first quarter and the first 2 or 3 quarters informing what was really our passion at Avitec, which was to build product. And I wanted to run that group, and I was rejected, which was turned out to be great for the group because somebody at corporate that knew how to get things done within BEA ended up running it. Is now the CIO of eBay, and he ran that group. And then I tried to help the services team continue to be successful, but ultimately that wasn't a strategic vector of the company, so I punched out.
So a year and a half, how long did you stay at BEA?
2.
And what was your experience at BEA?
Well, probably a worthy story is the negotiation process in the sale, and that was maybe a story on the value of partnership, and that was Tim's got a lot more experience in negotiating things and I think takes a little bit more sane approach to those kinds of things and make sure that we always have a comparison and that we want to try... We're gonna try on all different kinds of hats. Worst case scenario hats, best case scenario hats, all these different flavors to make sure that we're doing the analysis right on these things. Well, Navidec was another one of these roll up basically, and I had the same issues with what was going on, and BEA was not. BEA was completely towards product. I was completely sold on where they're at. I was completely sold on they were gonna be actually one of these winners out of the whole job application space. I was done. soon as they basically made inroads into where we're at, I was like, when are we starting? You know, this was exactly where I wanted to be. And I remember the week before, I think it was maybe 3 days before we were about ready to close, and Tim came in and said, you know what, I'm thinking about this scenario, and it was just like the worst case BEA scenario. And my heart dropped to the floor, and I was like, no, we're not going to choose. It was a total emotional reaction on my part. I was like, holy cow. Now, he was just trying out the deal to make sure that we were both sold and with which was the right deal. And he was testing me. He was just, you know.
No, I was ready to walk.
He can, anyway, great, great analytical capability to take some of the emotion out when you need to, when I was completely off the deep end. And so I ended up taking 7 of our engineers and starting the product group that Tim was talking about, run by Mark Cargis, who's the CTO at eBay right now, one of our larger customers. And we had just a great experience. Our first 3 releases were done in 3 months. We got to the end of the first year and found out that we underspent dramatically. We should have grown a lot faster. We left a ton of money on the table. So we ended up growing to $0 to $50 million run rate in 12 months at BEA with that product line. It was gangbusters. You could, anything on top of a Java application server through a sales channel of 700 sales reps goes like gangbusters. And it went like gangbusters. Those guys were sitting next to the fax machine in 99, 2000, even into 2001, just watching it come off. And it was great.
This was the portal product.
This is the portal product sitting on top of BEA's product. We grew to 125 engineers. We ended up with 3 development facilities. We closed one of those 2 development facilities, folded them back into Boulder. We got onto 18-month release cycles with the big product. Everything just ground to a halt. We almost killed ourselves on a release. Steve Wilcox, one of our senior engineers, got just amazingly ill through part of that process. It was some of the worst times of our life. At the same time, it was some of the best times of our lives. So I tried to, instead of roll up what we were doing for product management across the country, I tried to do an entrepreneuring effort. The result of that was we bought a spinoff out of Microsoft, CrossGain, which is a tools product, which was kind of where we were talking about. And that was my choice. It was entrepreneuring or out, and I chose out.
So you're torturing yourself trying to get this release out. At the other end of the work
life. He's on a boat.
On the end of, the other end of the work-life balance spectrum, you've quit, and you spent a year on a boat. How did you get to that decision? What was the sort of thought process? You're in your prime. You just came off a big success with this company. You've got plenty of bucks. You're an entrepreneur in demand. It's still a pretty heady time, right? The world hadn't fallen apart yet.
Yeah, no.
What played into your choice to go take a year off?
So I was sitting in an office being told not to build, not to grow, and ultimately not to sell, and not to talk to my customers. It's like, and I was getting paid an obscene amount of money to sit there and do nothing because the stock options were vesting and BEA had gone from 8 to 80. So
and split twice.
Yeah, that includes the splits, I think. He's the factual one tonight. That's good. So I had a lot of creative tension and energy that I needed to do something big. I was bored out of my mind, and I said, you know, what could I do that would be really big? And I started thinking about it. I remember thinking about it for days, and I didn't share it with my wife, Jerry, who is in the audience. And finally, I kind of put it all together in my head, and I said, this is the biggest, boldest, craziest thing I can do. Let's go. Take our kids, drop out, live on a boat, sail around the world. And when I gave her the pitch, I said, you can't say anything until I get it all out, because I was so committed even after 3 or 4 days that if she had stopped me, it would have just crushed me, because I was convinced. And I made this pitch to her, and at the end she said, sure, let's go. And, you know, if a company can't give an entrepreneur a challenge, then they've got to force themselves to do something else. And I really wanted to spend time with my kids. I was working long and hard hours, so that was definitely the best year and a half of my life.
Cool. So how did you know, you're on your boat, you're now coming back, Re-entering society, learning how to brush your teeth again every day. How did Rally get formed? What was sort of the impetus behind it? What was the sort of beginning stages of that?
On the exercise leaving BEA, I'd done a lot of work on what was happening next in the industry, and so I was convinced that the internet technology that we knew that was driving browsers would be driving machine-to-machine communications, what most people call web services nowadays, and that was going to have a huge impact on the application server, on application space, not the infrastructure, the plumbing of software. So I set out and actually started talking to companies like Raindance and others about how to make systems talk to each other, and we should create these environments where we merge different systems on the internet. So you could, this was my pitch to Raindance, was we could take video conferencing with medical imaging, and we'd be making some vertical conferencing system for doctors to be able to serve now very much more narrow market spaces by combining these web properties and web services applications. And I went to, this was right after September 11th. Everything was pretty much done at that point in time. Everybody looked at me like, that would have been great about a year ago. We would have bought into that whole story, but we're not buying anything now. And so it turned from that to the only application space that I really knew how to do was project management for software development teams. And it was based on project management for what worked for us at Avatech, which was small, short time boxes. And if we could do that, but do it with lots of teams, we would build fundamentally a different project management system, one that was a Microsoft project that showed us this amazing amount of stuff, but one that allowed us to see just what was in our context, but it would roll up so that we could run real big projects with lots of small teams. And so that was the genesis.
So you have this germ of a new idea. How did you go from germ of a new idea to something that was more substantive? What were the people that you got around you, financing? What did that look like for the first year or so?
So there's some great stories. So Tim's off in a boat. All the folks that we hired at BEA are still at BEA. I had a great experience with the CTO. I couldn't feel like I could steal people. I didn't have anything really yet. So I ended up hooking up with a friend back from 1994. After I'd left the consulting company Tim and I were at, we started working on this together and said, hey, we're going to form this thing, but there's still a lot of venture money around. I want to do this as a product company. I want it to be a subscription business. That's really important to what we're doing because that's part of what's changing the software industry. And so we're not going to have a lot of license revenue on the front side to grow this. We need to figure this out as a nice, slow subscription business. Well, just about before we were going to close, $400,000 in friends and family money, he backed out after we'd already divvied up the founder's pie, which was a huge mistake. Luckily, not something I worry about anymore, but it was certainly a learning experience.
So just to be clear, when you say you divvied it up, his stock was not subject to restricted vesting?
Correct.
So he's walking away with a percentage of the company.
He'll make a little bit of money.
Yeah, he's going to make a little bit of money.
Okay.
So that was a mistake.
I always like it when there's a legal takeaway from these conversations.
Yes. I substituted somebody
minor
else.
Minor relevance. Huh? Yeah. Thanks for the conference room, by the
So you can see where I'm strong and where I'm weak. It's certainly coming out right now, right? So I'm missing a lot without him here. I substitute somebody else in, and actually Legiel. Legiel was the holdout, and I got Legiel over the hurdle, and I set a bar for myself. If I couldn't raise $350,000, I couldn't do this company. So that was my first hurdle.
When you say you got Legiel over the hurdle, as an investor.
As an investor.
So for those of you that don't know Jim Legiel, he was Jim's now the CFO at Rally, but he was one of the founders of Raindance and did a bunch of angel investing and then started a company called Oxlo, which is still going. But he was sort of part of
Tim and Jerry were in. I'd gotten a bunch of people that we knew about. Don was in from who's our EVP of sales. Parents, in-laws. Let's go a little further into a couple other. My old boss was in, and so I substituted Jim in. I cleared the 350, and that was the toughest question, was to sign the piece of paper that took $350,000 from friends and family.
So you raised a friends and family round. At this time, the auspicious name of the company was?
F4 Technologies.
Yes.
F4 Technologies, and this was all done basically working out of Brad's incubator, which had some space at that point in time, in the end of 2001. And it was done on a prototype of what we thought this thing would look like, and some promises from the BEA team that, yeah, this looked like something we'd want to use. And so that you could do that back then. Obviously, that's not the case today, but you could do that back then. And we built out that prototype, got a beta working, got it to a place that now we had some customers who said we would take money, that we could take money off the table for doing this thing. We got to a Series A. Talked to all, I don't know how many times I did practice pitches in the Mobius incubator. I'm guessing 60. I'm guessing Seth and Chris and maybe a little bit of Howard and various Mike Stack and others here in the room had to be wondering, how's he going to do this? Because I just can't, I don't think like an investor, I think like customers. I was building the app for myself, I was building the app for the BEA team, I knew exactly what we were building, but to communicate it and to say, look, it's going to be a subscription service. Subscription software? I mean, there's this thing called Salesforce, they had about, 1,000 free customers at that point in time and no revenue. And it's this thing called Agile, these little time boxes. Who does Agile? What is Agile? What? All of this stuff was new, and it was way early. And Brad's team figured out that there was something here. I think only because I had traipsed so many people through that everybody else was proof. Now, I don't think I could describe it to save my soul.
We gave up. We couldn't bear to see
it
again.
Brute force, right?
So, but Tim, how did you get involved? So he's raised the angel round. You're now raising the first venture round.
Tim's at EIR Boulder Ventures, and Kyle's comes into the picture on this one. So.
Well, Ryan first sent me the business plan while we were on the boat, and I read it. And it was after dinner, and it was a beautiful day, and we might have had a few drinks, and I just ripped it. I just said, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. It'll never have any success. But on the boat, we had a satellite phone for data, so we'd queue things up, and I knew I shouldn't send it, so I put it, you know, in drafts, or I left it up, and Jerry got on the computer and sent it because she wanted to check email, right? And you had to send it to check email. Oh, boy, he was pissed. We probably had three fights or so in our professional career in 20 years, but he was pissed, and I was not polite at all. So that was my first introduction to the company. He did convince me to invest in. I have to tell you, I didn't invest in the idea. I invested in the person because I was sure he'd figure it out. And quite frankly, the space that we were attacking isn't the space that we're attacking today. So I'm going to say I was at least a teeny bit right in at least the market focus of the product. And I hope you don't mind me sharing this. Ryan was kind of at wit's end. We were out of money. He was out of money. I was on the board, so I helped him a little bit. I helped him recruit some folks. But the company was out of money, and we couldn't get a fundraising done. And Ryan was going to run the company as the CEO. Kyle Lufkoff came and said, we'll just put these two companies together, or two people together, and we'll make it work. And we'll fund it, and Brad will fund it, and we'll get the deal done. So that's exactly what we did. And Ryan stepped down from being the CEO to the CTO, which, you know, is kind of a hard thing to do. We got together in a room. We got on a whiteboard. We said, well, what do you really want to do? And it's like, I want to do this. And what do you really want to do? And I really want to do this. And we lined them up, and there was no overlap. I mean, we truly like to do different things. We share a common viewpoint and mental model, but we're very different people, and somehow we figured out how to make that harmonious. So I joined the company commensurate with our Series A fundraise as the CEO, and the rest is history.
How was your first year at Rally?
I think it was probably the worst year of my professional career. I'm not sure if I've ever shared this. I don't know.
That was a leading question.
Yeah,
and And I'm not exactly sure why. I mean, I had some personal things going on, but it is hard to come back off the boat and go back to work. But we didn't have any customers, so we didn't have any positive feedback from the market or from our customers. Ryan is a turtle, and he can just keep moving and crawling forward and making progress. I need more positive feedback. It's why I didn't succeed in the PhD program in finance, quite frankly, because it is not a positive feedback environment. So not having any customers that are willing to pay us real money meant that it was all 100% at risk and there was potential for a complete zero. I hated that.
So your Series A was 2004?
Three.
So 2003, tough year, 2004. 2005, you start having customers. You raised some more money.
Yeah, we got Don on in the end of 2004.
Yep.
We got Gene Tabaka, local coach, on in the end of 2004. We had some early customers, handful, 20 or so, paying us subscription revenue. And I think 2004 was $50,000 in revenue.
Yeah, just met the hurdle in the fastest growing companies, which gave us a growth rate of like 4,000% in 2 years.
Right.
So we've invested $3.5 million, and we, at the end of, we rewrote the entire prototype, we threw it in the trash, and we had $50,000 in revenue for $3.5 million in investment in what was now 6 man years of work.
You talked about sniffing evil and the scarring experience of having to work with someone at a critical stage. How did that translate into the early hires that you made at Rally and the vetting process that you went through there?
We hired folks we knew.
The
BEA thing was off. Steve had taken some time off. We picked him up. Two people that we had worked with before back in US West days in early 94, we picked up a couple of key engineers out of BEA that were on the services side. And so that first team was all known. And then we kind of slowly started vetting different people along the way, mostly with contract to hire kinds of terms, if it wasn't something we didn't know. So we would hire you on a contract. If that worked out, we could extend that into an offer, but we were having people work on projects.
But we've also hired, we hired a VP that got demoted to a director. We hired another VP that we fired 3 or 4 months later. We hired another VP that we fired a year plus later. We hired another VP that we fired 6 months later. There might be another VP, right? So it was bloody, and it is. It's part of my core beliefs on how you build a great company. You get rid of the folks that don't fit culturally, because back what I said earlier is one person can ruin the whole business.
The Rally today is how many people?
We have probably 155 on payroll, and then maybe another 20 contractors.
When you wind the clock forward a year, how many people do you think you'll be at the end of this year?
I think we're hiring about 75 on the current plan, but it's probably a little aggressive.
Before you leave the historical contract, could you talk a little bit about where the Rolodex failed in terms of bringing customers on board, or as the market focus was not correct, right? Clearly, you guys had customers in mind. You had good connections. You had built up over a long period of time that Rolodex. But it's failing at this point.
Well, actually, I don't know that I would have said it failed. I would have said we got some early customers, a lot of locals, and some other pieces. The BEA thing never came to pass. They ended up buying something else. And they didn't get Agile, the team that we had come from, really, because it wasn't really the older team anyway. We generated all our leads inbound based on people who were interested in Agile that were self-describing. Based on basically paper clicking.
The failure was in fundraising, not in the product.
Yeah.
So
undercapitalization.
No, I couldn't raise money by myself because I couldn't tell a story to investors because I couldn't put their hat on. I could tell you what was going to happen in the marketplace, but that didn't transfer into dollars to make a successful company. Put the two of us together.
He just didn't get it.
Oh, no, that wasn't his problem, but I'm not going to speak for him, but I don't think that was the problem.
When you invested, was it the people, or was it the plan, or a little bit of both?
It was probably both. The dynamics that I remember this cycle, and I would separate sort of two points in time, because I know where your question's coming from, which was $50,000 of revenue after $3.5 million invested. That was actually about what was expected.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they were doing fine. Yeah, they were on track. The issue was the subscription model. They were selling these three-year projects, and the monthly revenue that they were getting was relatively small, but because it's recurring, it built very nicely. To Brad, to your question, I was very interested in investing in Rally, and Mobius had a good history of making some investments in software tools companies. We had a few others that had been very successful over the years, and I was pretty comfortable with that personally. I think there was dissonance around the idea, and culturally within Mobius, the idea of us doing an investment by ourselves as a firm. It was very negative towards that. And this was sort of post-bubble. So we'd also been through our own bullshit. And, you know, I'd had a lot of success pre-bubble and then a lot of stress, you know, sort of 2001, 2002. And sort of the general tone within Mobius as a firm was, hey, Brad, sounds great. Find somebody else to do it with. That was kind of the tempo. And so in Foundry, we don't subscribe to that. We're happy to do stuff by ourselves. But at the time, you know, whether I didn't have enough juice or courage or whatever to get it done, what happened was essentially in the venture community, there tends to be a lot of early stage venture firms who are afraid to make investments by themselves. And especially sort of right post-bubble, you had a lot of that mentality. Everybody wanted, hey, if somebody else is interested, that might validate it, that'll help us leverage things, et cetera. And I think when I was in Alaska when all this happened, I remember Ryan called me and said, hey, Kyle's forcing Tim on me, was basically what he said. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, Kyle said he'd, and you've been pitching Boulder for a long time. I mean, Tim had been working on Boulder coming in, and I think I had basically said, hey, I'm in if we can get something to come together. And I said to Ryan, well, before you react emotionally to it, just wear it for 24 hours. You know, you guys have worked together before. Don't react. I think you called me right after you'd had the conversation.
Sure. Yeah.
I said, don't react. Just sit with it. And let's talk tomorrow. And when you called me back the next day, he's like, I think this is a great idea. So once that sort of emotional piece had worn off. The other thing which was really interesting was, and the place where I was going to go in terms of your question, if you look at success, I think that Rally is undeniably an extremely successful company and has been for the life of the company. It's been at a very steady, solid growth pace for the type of business it's at. A couple of rounds ago, they had a new investor come in, and the investor said, man, there's a lot of stake here, but there's no sizzle. And like the fourth time he said that, I'm like, dude, don't you get it? These guys are like, don't you want that? Isn't that good? They built something that was very substantive and very deliberate, but it wasn't sexy. And part of that was the domain, part of that was, you know, the evolution of the company. And it was very interesting, sort of as it unfolded over time, to see both Tim and Ryan get comfortable with a business that wasn't driving on the revenue side faster than the cost side. Because Avatech had been a business that you had to make money every month. And there was, in this time period, there was a lot of sort of internal tone of, are we succeeding or not? Because we need to raise more money, we need to da 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 da. And it's been very interesting, even, you know, if you wind the clock backwards 2 or 3 years, there was a point at which it became clear the company was successful, and sort of that imbalance went away. And I think it's worth talking about. You started talking about the difference between a self-funded, bootstrapped consulting business and a venture-backed product business. You want to spend a few minutes sort of, you know, looking backwards on what the difference between those two are?
Well, a professional services company is a really simple business. You sell the work, you manage the work, you do the work, you make your customers happy, they hire you again, and you repeat. You know, you just keep repeating. And we did a couple of things in our business, and my wife was great. We had basically her and a intern running almost a $10 million business just with the two of them when we had maybe 10 in accounting at Rally when we were doing half the revenue, right? So it's a clean, efficient business if you pay attention to doing it that way. So I was able to grow and learn by going to YEO and other things to help me develop my leadership skills and keep quite a few steps ahead of what was demanded of me to grow at that pace in that business.
YEO being Young Entrepreneurs,
Young Entrepreneurs Organization, which is a phenomenal mentorship group. A venture-backed company, well, first of all, a product company has sales, has marketing, has product development, has a real IT, or, you know, it's a real company, whereas the services is just a big project that you get paid for and you kind of scale up a little bit. So I didn't know anything about product development. Of course, Ryan came from that background, which helped tremendously. But I would go into meeting after meeting and have absolutely no idea what the right decision was or how to make that decision or be able to define a strategic vector for what we're... That wasn't me, and it still isn't me, except I've been doing it for 6 years now, so I've heard Ryan repeat it enough and have told the story enough that it's become very easy. Managing a board. I had some pretty tumultuous board meetings in the first couple of years. I'm not sure I've reflected on a whole lot and understand it, but...
Most of the assholes on your board.
Well, it could be. It could be. I actually fought with Brad more because I cared more about what he said than some of the others. But having a boss, everybody works for somebody, but... having been an entrepreneur for 6-7 years and not having a boss, it's very different. And when you deeply care about what your bosses think because of the respect that you have for them, and the others in the room too, it's a lot more stressful. Obviously, taking other people's money. I mean, we took other people's money this last time, and it felt pretty easy, but we took $16 million, and the company's worth more than $100 million, and it's like all of a sudden, you know, that feels like nothing to me now, but that first $3 million and Ryan's first $400,000, or his parents were going to go out $100,000 or whatever they invested in the company, that's hard. That's really hard.
So we're at about 1:30. If people have things to go to, because we had scheduled for 1:30, feel free to get up any time. But maybe we'll do some Q&A before we wrap up for another 10, 15 minutes or so.
I have a services startup. So I'm going back to the early years of Avitech. We came from a corporate or an employee, and we started our own company. What were some of the things that you guys had to learn that made you successful at Avitech? And what are some of the things that you had to unlearn?
He said, what are some of the successful things we learned at Avitech early days? I think the one thing I mentioned was Tim and Jerry's, because Jerry was running our accounting at that point in time, was billing our customers every week. Billing our customers every week gave us a fast feedback loop as to whether we had a good one or a bad one. And even if we had a good, we didn't know, we would know 3 weeks in if they weren't going to pay us, and therefore we would go walk to their accounting department and figure out why it was stuck, what we needed to fill out so we could get paid in week four, so that we didn't have any AR. As a result, we could fund our own growth. That was a huge piece of the business. Of what was successful. I mean, I mentioned the one failure of writing a foreclosure app. The next failure that I had was as an intern in graduate school, I worked for a company called down in Westminster that was in the geographic information systems space, Generation 5. And so they had married AutoCAD with Oracle Database to compete with a company called Esri ArcInfo. And it seemed like a great thing to me. I was a civil engineer. I knew exactly what they were doing. We're going to do queries using spatial data and drag polygons all over the place. This is cool. We got an open systems approach. I know what we're doing. Great. Well, they're running a little tight on money. So what they're going to do is offer everybody stock internally. So I was like, wow, this is cool. I'm going to have stock in the company. I think they're doing great. Call my dad up. I need to borrow some money. Can you let me borrow some money? Well, okay, on a forward loan, as kind of everything is with my dad, and I borrowed the money, and I think it was 2 years later, because I graduated and then went up to Bozeman, Montana. I owned, I think it was 50,000 shares in a Chinese wool importer. Because the company had gone to zero, they bought the company for the stock rights on the NASDAQ exchange and to be liquid in NASDAQ, and I owned 50,000 shares of a Chinese wool importer. So that was the second failure in software development that I saw. So I kind of got my learnings out of the hard knocks of where a lot of these pitfalls lie. I'm seeing a lot of, and then obviously shipping 1,000 bad boards when you're up, and I didn't ship them. I wasn't the engineer that did it. Wasn't even our product line, but it pretty much killed. There's so many potholes on the way in the product business that when you're spending it all yourself, that's why I knew it had to be venture-backed. I was like, yeah, I made some money through the 2,000 years, but I'm not putting my entire future potential nest egg on the line. I've invested incrementally along the way as the risk profile's gone down. But those are two very different businesses. Making the jump from services to product is tough, very tough. And you bet the whole business. You bet a cash flow positive lifestyle, fully funding growing business on something that has thousands of potholes, let alone a completely different culture and a completely different operating model. And you have to figure it out.
One piece of advice I learned was utilization, which is the number of hours billable divided by the number of hours available, is the smart number in services, and that rates and realization and all the other stuff don't matter. If people are billable 90 to 100% of the time, it's sustainable, and really smart people, if they're not billable 90% or 100% of the time, find other things to do that aren't valuable to the company. And we kept it pegged every month, right about that.
I have a question for Tim. Obviously, you talk a lot about corporate culture and the importance of it to be in a small business. And I think you talked a little bit about hiring and maybe some of that situation when you fire a client because you wanted to make sure your employees knew 24/7 wasn't the way. What are other ways that you've shaped and maintained corporate culture as you are growing, you know,
Yeah, probably the rhythm of the company is something that we do that helps reinforce all our behaviors. So we have daily stand-up meetings with every department. We have weekly meetings now. My management team is 25 people that spend an hour every week syncing and checking in and looking at our numbers. We have monthly meetings with the whole company. We have quarterly strategic planning meetings with 50, 60, 70 people every quarter. We have an annual meeting that similar format. And that sort of rhythm really helps with one of the core values, which is make and meet commitments. So you say what you're going to do in the stand-up, and you do it, and the next day you report that, yes, I got it done, or no, I didn't, and I'm blocked, and I need help. And, of course, if you get up and say you're going to do something and you keep not doing it, then you probably don't last very long in our organization. So some way to get everybody to communicate about one of the core values, that's just one of six that we have, but it's constantly reinforced and it's baked into sort of everything that we do.
Oh, we went around and twisted a few arms. Yeah, it was friends and family.
The question was, how did you get your first paying customer at Rally?
The guys down in Westminster, Roving Planet. So worked with one person on the team knew the person who was the head of engineering. They needed a solution in this space. There weren't very many good ones. There weren't any really at that point in time. We were the first hosted one. It was pretty low commitment.
They wanted to drive the features of the product because they were passionate about it.
Yep. Found passionate customers. Those were the first five, for sure.
How important is evangelizing Agile been to your strategy?
It's been really important. Obviously, the question was, how important is evangelizing Agile been to our strategy? It's been very important. There are two ways that the world, or Jeffrey Moore, the guy who wrote the Bible on high-tech product marketing, would tell you about how to, in essence, open up a market. One is on a new technology. Call it a 3G network instead of a 1G network or a 4G network. It's a new platform that you're going to enter on. The other is on a thematic concept, a theme. We entered on a theme. It's called Agile. It's called working in small time boxes with lots of feedback, with high priorities and making meeting commitments. So evangelizing the theme and creating the market, because our product has in it an odd set of features that was never in any other product before when we came out, and what was this thing? And we didn't fit in any one of the Gartner pictures because we weren't a project management system, and we weren't a tool system, and we weren't a build system, we weren't an SCM system, but we were parts of a lot of those things. So we were creating something new. So we've spent a good bit of our money during that period was to create this market. And so education was a big part of what we were doing, hiring coaches early, and making sure that our customers were successful with working in an agile manner has been we differentiate on service and success. We don't differentiate on low price or the newest, craziest, most innovative thing in the world next week. It's around making sure people are successful. So it's part and parcel to our strategy.
Two more questions.
Today,
three more questions. You, and then you.
Today, what would you say is your most critical strategic problem for 2 or 3 in the realm of going from where you are to where you next are going to be?
We are in a place now where IBM has entered the marketplace, where Computer Associates has entered the marketplace, where Microsoft is making more progress. It's now become a market where we're selling not Rally as a product, but Rally as a company. This round of funding was instrumental in having us show up as a company that could potentially go public. We enter into a sales cycle like we did last week in closing Intel for all of their software engineers in comparing ourselves against other major companies in the marketplace. We have to look like we're going to be around, and we have to behave like we're going to be around, and we have to be able to talk to them through the entire sales cycle and the entire process like we know how to do this as well as any of those people do. In fact, we know how to do it better. And so as a company of 160, we're competing, obviously, with one of the major divisions at IBM of measured in tens of thousands of employees. So for us, I think that stature in the marketplace and making sure that everybody knows we're selling the whole company now. We're not just selling you being able to do X and change one company. No, it's that we're going to be your partner for a long time.
We also have about 25 competitors on the low end that are stealing market share. So we have that dichotomy in our business where we have to win in the large. But because of the way Agile's adopted in our product, we actually have to get in when they're relatively small, too, in order to seed those accounts when large. So we have a fairly complex sort of go-to-market in how we win.
There's one there. Yeah.
How much of a general time financial? Once you start up Rally, he has a mate to make sure it runs smoothly, to make sure he doesn't fall victim to insider trading or other broader financial scandals, make sure that employees are practicing ethical business standards.
Well, we're a highly collaborative company. We talked about the stand-up. So, we have very few offices, for instance, right? So the execs have offices, but I just can't imagine, based on the strength of our culture, that people would do evil things. But having said that, we use KPMG, who's a phenomenal firm to do audits. Our first accounting hire was a really senior controller here in town who had actually managed fraud and things like that in the past. So you set up controls and systems to take care of that. It is something that I haven't thought about, except for the last time the auditors asked as part of the audit, are you aware of any fraud? And the time before was the year before when they asked. It's just not something I think about. We have people that do worry, but not I.
I think just one other thing from a board perspective, you guys have been very deliberate about at each growth segment putting systems in place as the risks got bigger, in terms of number of people that had to sign off on things, or the way the contracts flow through, or the way the revenue recognition works. And that's a cultural phenomenon within the company. And many startup companies don't do a particularly good job at the step functions, right? They might be good at the beginning, and then they get to a certain size, and they don't really have the muscle or the understanding how to do it. Or they get to a certain size, and then they put too much bureaucracy on top of everything else and slows the organization down. And of all the companies I've been involved in, these guys have been one of the best in terms of navigating through that. And I think it's a testament to the people that they've hired that are in those sort of key financial roles.
Thank you.
Last question was there.
Yeah, I had a funny question. You talked about services starting out. You were very familiar with it, comfortable with it. It's easy. You do it. You build it. You lap over at your feet. Then you said it's kind of scary starting a products company. You know, but you've done both, and now you say you're selling the brand Rally rather than selling the product, the software, or the service. But I'm kind of curious, what makes more? And you're saying now you may be losing market share. What are you losing market share of? Services or software or both?
We're the market share on product because we have competitors that sell for 10 cents on the dollar or 25 cents on the dollar.
I think defining what losing market share means is important. You're gaining aggregate market share, but there's a segment of the market.
The market is growing tremendously. And let's be clear, we aren't losing market share. We have new players that are gaining market share.
In an expanding market.
We have one in particular that's growing faster than we are, if you believe a study that I just read today. But that product generates a lot less revenue, I believe. So did that answer your question?
Yes. You basically said one of the things that made the most sense is, yes, while we're growing very large, it's not that one person is taking it away from us. It's not one.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, the pie is getting bigger, and our slice of that pie is we need to make sure that we get the slice that we're differentiated in the marketplace on, and we want to make sure that even from the smallest to the largest, that people are looking for that thing. They find us and get started with us and get comfortable and become a partner. But we know we don't get all the market because we're not differentiated on low cost completely. We don't have the lowest cost solution, nor do we have the one with the brightest, shiniest, whiz-bang things every week. But you got to struggle through the fact that it's the brightest, shiniest, whiz-bangy thing that works for one person but doesn't work for everybody else. Our process now has a rollout process associated with it. Goes to 5 or 10 customers first. It then gets out to about a larger segment before. So everything's in a controlled rollout so that we have, you know, continuous reliability, continuous availability from all the way around the world, and engineers in India can use the product with a response time that's, you know, sub 1 second, as well as in engineers in the U.S.
One of the add-on to that comment that I'd make is when Rally started, the notion, or even F4 started, the notion of Agile was a brand new idea. Today, it's a pretty mainstream idea in software development. And one of the challenges that Rally has gone after tenaciously is expanding their footprint well beyond software development, because essentially lean and agile apply to any sort of product development. And a number of your larger growing customers are not just software development organizations, but product development organizations. And so when you talk about market share, what you do is if you can increase your market potential by an order of magnitude on a percentage basis, all of a sudden you just decreased your share, right, by an order of magnitude, so you can grow into it again. So that, I think that's something that's been very deliberate in the last 12 months.
Yep.
My final question is for you, Tim. You said that when you interview people, that you ask them one question, and that is, if an alien comes down,
yes,
the mothership,
yep,
if you say anything but no, then you'll be hired. My question is, if an alien came down and asked you, Elvis up there, would you go?
Elvis, oh boy, it's just his birthday. First of all, I wouldn't go anywhere without my wife. But I'd probably take me 2 or 3 days to really work up the story. Then I'd pitch it to her, and I'm pretty sure.
Well,
thank you, guys. Thanks. That was awesome. Thank you guys for coming and being part of this. And we'll hang around for a little bit afterwards for one-on-one questions, and hope to see you at another one of these.